let me get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us.
You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org.
Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds.
Today on Under Surveillance, you'll hear the conclusion of a two-part discussion on the resurgence of superhero fiction in film and television. My guest is pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, and we'll be talking about everything from the failed superhero films of the 1990s, to recent successful Superman TV dramas like Lois and Clark and Smallville, to the portrayal of supervillains over the last few decades. We'll jump right into the conversation with Leonard's thoughts on the big screen revival plans for DC's Wonder Woman.
Every time there's a new comics film introduced, which has, I mean, it's almost every day now, another piece of work that I do is I'm a film blogger for Nerve.com's Screen Grab blog, which is an indie and mainstream film blog, and I sort of have inherited the position of writing about comic book movies, and time was that, you know, you would have to wait months between the announcement of one comic book movie and the next, and now there's a new one every day being announced. And so every time one is announced, especially if it's a comic that you're fond of, you're like, oh, how are they going to screw it up? You know, what are they going to do wrong? And sometimes those fears are not justified, but frequently they are. You know, another one that you haven't mentioned yet that actually is coming up and a lot of people are both excited and trepidatious about is the Wonder Woman film, which the casting is not yet complete, and obviously that's going to be key, but Joss Whedon of Buffy the Vampire Slayer fame is set to direct it. And,
oh, really? Okay, because he was supposed to write the screenplay, and then he ditched that assignment?
He supposedly has been reattached to it, so, that's the latest news. I mean, you know, who knows what will happen. I remember the Superman film that just came out, the Superman Returns. That went through so many configurations of screenwriter, director. It's the same thing with the Watchmen film. You know, it's been rumored to have been in the works almost since the comic came out, which was 1986. So 20 years now, it's been rumored to be just around the corner, and, you know, there's been a dozen different directors attached to it. So.
And now they're going to have the guy who directed 300, apparently, right? Direct Watchmen?
We'll see when it hits the screen, if it does so.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and today I'm joined once again by Leonard Pierce, and we're talking about superhero fiction in film and television. So in between the Batman films and the Michael Keaton and Tim Burton films, and then you had Danny DeVito and Val Kilmer and George Clooney, and I forgot about Arnold Schwarzenegger playing Mr. Freeze later on.
Right.
Kind of the death knell, right, of that series?
Definitely the low point, yeah.
Yeah. But we also had a few very low-budget films based on Marvel characters in that decade. We had the live-action Captain America and Punisher films that both went direct-to-video. The Punisher film starred Dolph Lundgren.
This would be the first Punisher film.
First Punisher film, exactly.
One that came out a few years ago with Thomas Jane in it, yeah.
I don't think that one did very well at all either.
No, it didn't, with good reason. The Punisher has been a controversial character even in its comic book incarnation because, you know, the Punisher, for those who are not familiar with the character, is he's taken not out of the superhero universe, but out of the sort of men's adventure genre, you know, like the Executioner and the Destroyer. You know, he's this sort of one-man war against crime type. His family was wiped out by mobsters. And, you know, a lot of the reasons that traditional superhero fans are not fond of the character unless he's treated as a villain is because he kills people. You know, he's just a side of being a homicidal maniac. And, you know, I think that sort of character has potential, but a lot of comic book fans have always been sort of uncomfortable with the character because of that, you know, that he's best treated maybe as just the side of a villain. And it's not really unusual for a film to portray a character like that. I mean, there have been tons of characters from...
Well, the Death Wish series. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are just millions of movie characters like that, but... adding it into the element of superhero fiction always seems a little jarring to people, it seems.
Yeah, I think of the Punisher as basically the evolutionary Charles Bronson Death Wish character. But also, in addition to the Punisher and the Captain America films, we had the Roger Corman Fantastic Four film made back in 1994. Have you seen the film?
I have. I saw it back when it was still sort of illegal to own it for copyright reasons, and there was always bootleg DVDs of it floating around for a while before I finally got legal clearance to be shown, and it's terrible.
Yeah, this is a film that wasn't released in theaters, did not even go to video, and from what I've read recently on Wikipedia, although I don't know if it's entirely accurate, but the film was made solely to secure copyrights to the property. They were running out of time. And unless they made something using these characters, they'd lose the rights to them. And that they didn't even tell Roger Corman or anyone else involved with the production that the film was never going to be released.
Yeah, that's correct. It's actually part of a sort of stellar history of weird copyright restrictions involved in both films and comic books. There used to be a comic that DC put out called Canceled Comics Cavalcade. And it was this comic that came out once a year. And it featured stories of characters who had been created just to protect a particular copyright. And, you know, they would only ever appear in these stories so that they could claim the copyright for it for another 7 years or however long it took. And then you also have a number of characters who actually went on to some prominence who were also created for the same reason. A She-Hulk was created just because Marvel wanted to hold on to the copyright of a female version of the Hulk. And so they created She-Hulk for no reason other than to protect that copyright. And, you know, it actually grew into a pretty popular character. But, yeah, that's exactly why the film was made, to protect the copyright on the Fantastic Four character.
Yeah, and undoubtedly one of the worst films I've ever seen. I'm sure that's true for you as well, too. And the special effects that were involved were just incredible. You had Mr. Fantastic, whose ability is to stretch his limbs and elongate them. And you see him, I think, stretching once at the very end of the show, where you see kind of a rubber arm attached to a hand that he's waving outside of a limousine. I remember that part from the very end. But you have Dr. Doom wearing this terry cloth kind of outfit, kind of costume. And, mm-hmm. and the Human Torch only... flames on for one part of the movie. So from beginning to end, even though I think they spent $3 million making this film.
Yeah, I guess $3 million doesn't go as far as it used to.
Certainly not when it comes to superhero feats and portraying superhero action.
No.
Are you familiar at all with the series The Flash that appeared on CBS for a year?
I am not. It's in my Netflix queue, you know, because I'll pretty much watch anything with a superhero in it, but... my understanding is it's not particularly good. I have seen the pilot to the Aquaman show, which came out last year and was immediately canceled, and it's by the same people, so I sort of know what I'm in for, but I do plan on watching it anyway, for no other reason than I'm sort of fond of the character. But
when was the Aquaman pilot released?
It was last year.
Oh, last year? Okay, on what station?
It was syndicated, and I think it ended up on UPN. Yeah, it came and went in a heartbeat. It was terrible. They sort of did the same approach that they do with Smallville, in that, you know, it focused less on his costumed antics and supervillains than it did sort of his personal life and development, but it was just really hokey and terrible.
Can you talk a little bit about Smallville and also the adventures of Lois and Clark?
Sure, yeah. There was actually sort of in the 1990s and carrying on into today, there was a wave of Superman television shows. There's the Adventures of Lois and Clark with Dean Cain, which sort of approached it as a, you know, the Superman mythos as if it was a romantic comedy. And, you know, it was successful on its own terms. It wasn't really that satisfying for superheroics fans, but it was moderately well done. And then there was, there's also Smallville, which is still in production, I believe. And it sort of focuses on Superman's youth, but it almost completely forsakes a lot of the superheroic element. In fact, he's never seen in costume. It's just the adventures of Superman when he was a teenager and still learning to use his powers, and his relationship with a young Lex Luthor, and it played as a sort of a, you know, very angsty teen drama, and actually quite successful on its own terms. Again, you know, people who are expecting superheroics are going to be disappointed. There was always a monster of the week, you know, that he would use his powers to defeat, but the appeal of it was more in the characterization and the portrayal of his parents and his relationship with other teenagers and his feeling of alienation, and it's really not a bad show at all. It's not a traditional superhero show by any means, but it's an interesting approach to the character and sort of a sign that you have an audience who's willing to follow these characters in unusual directions.
Well, it comes down to the old axiom of what's television best at doing? It's best at portraying people talking and
right.
dialogue and long-running themes, whereas with films, you want the action, you want the big-budget heroics.
Right. You know, I think that's also part of the reason that Heroes is such a success right now, is that it's really focusing on the mystery and the enigma and the ability to carry on, you know, this sort of Lost-esque plot where you're not sure what's happening and, you know, there's a lot of mystery to be revealed and there's a lot of sitting around talking and asking questions and, you know, chasing down a mystery and very little actual action, but enough to keep people satisfied.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and today I'm joined by Leonard Pierce, and we're talking about the resurgence of superhero fiction in film and television with the upcoming Spider-Man 3 movie coming out next month. I believe it's the 14th Marvel release over the last decade, and also we have recently the new Batman film, Batman Begins, we have Superman Returns, and the resurrection of those franchises by DC. And we also have a slew of superhero films coming out in the next few years as well, too. So, villains in superhero fiction. It's certainly true of action films that a story is only as good as its villain. And that's the one element that I think has been missing in so many of the superhero films and television shows that we've seen. Why is that? Is that strictly due to budgetary reasons? You know, why do we have all these universes that are essentially self-contained, where we don't have characters interacting with other superpowered characters?
Well, part of it, I think, is the expense. You know, the more superheroic characters you load into a film, the more money you have to spend. But, you know, lately it's been shown that this can be accomplished. The X-Men movies have done it to a largely successful degree. They've shown that you can have, as long as you've got a decent writer and a good director, that you can have a lot of characters with a lot of powers interacting with a lot of other characters with a lot of powers and still have it work. In the past, I think the mistake has been not so much budgetary or, you know, even a matter of showing the villain being powerful enough as it is a bad approach to the villain, a lack of understanding of how he should behave. I think one of the flaws in the portrayal of Lex Luthor in the early Superman movies, even though it was well done by Gene Hackman, is that they made Luthor into a clown. You know, they portrayed him as a poltroon, you know, sort of a jokey, cowardly, self-absorbed sort of a joke. And, you know, Luthor has always worked in the comics because he's quite the opposite. He's extremely competent. He's very lethal. You know, he's brilliant. And, I mean, he doesn't have any powers, and yet he's able to stand up to Superman, who's the most powerful person on the planet. So they took the wrong approach with Luthor in those, and so he didn't seem very impressive. The reason that the second film succeeds so well, I think, is because of the choice of Terrence Stamp to play General Zod, a Kryptonian villain, and he's just so dripping with menace and so sinister that he, you know, every scene that he's in is just really riveting. I think a similar approach plays out with the X-Men movies because the portrayal of Magneto by Ian McKellen is so successful. You know, he portrays both his power and his menace and his sort of moral ambiguity, you know, the fact that he's really just sort of fighting for the liberation of his people in an extremist sort of way. And when you look at the Batman movies, for example, I think the first one worked well because Nicholson got a perfect handle on the Joker character, that sort of combination of sideshow carny-type dopey humor and just insane menace, you know, unpredictable lunacy, Whereas in some of the other films, Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze was a poor choice. Danny DeVito's portrayal of the Penguin was not particularly good. And so, you know, it's not really so much a question of getting the right special effects or having the character be powerful enough as it is understanding, you know, it's just as important, as we discussed before, to satisfy the fans by showing that you can understand what the hero is all about. And, you know, for instance, not making Batman campy and silly, it's just as important to understand what the villains are about and not show Lex Luthor as being campy and silly, or, you know, not show the Joker as being pure evil but having that sort of edge of whimsy to him. And, you know, if you don't understand the villain, you're going to fail just as surely as if you don't understand the hero.
I agree with you to an extent. I will say that a big reason that General Zod works so well in Superman 2 is the fact that he is as strong as Superman. He does have the same powers. I think it's a problem with the Superman character is that he's almost omnipotent, and he's basically impervious to almost everything except for kryptonite, and then he's reduced to a shell of a man. And I think it's...
There's even a term for that in comics criticism. It's called the Superman problem, which is how do you keep a character interesting if he can do anything, you know?
And that's the problem, I think, with Lex Luthor, is that the only way that he can stop Superman, both in Superman 1 and actually also in Superman Returns, is with kryptonite. Did you like Kevin Spacey's portrayal of Lex, then, in the new movie?
I thought it was okay. I thought it was closer to the conception of the character in the comics that I enjoy. But, you know, I didn't like the film that much. I thought it was really slowly paced. I thought that it doled out the action sequences in such tiny doses that it didn't keep you focused for particularly long. And I also think that one of the things that was really missing, and this is really key to it being a Superman movie rather than just being a superhero movie in general, is that it was a little dark, it was a little grim, and gloomy, and there was no real joy to it. And I think that's where, if nothing else, the early films succeeded in capturing that aspect of it. Superman is not Batman. Batman is a grim character in a grim setting with a grim origin. Everything about him is soaked in blood and bad feelings, whereas Superman, you know, despite having a sort of grim origin, you know, his whole planet being lost, has always been a sort of uplifting and life-affirming sort of character. He's not about vengeance and darkness and a grim psychology. And, you know, I thought that part of why the Superman Returns film failed is because it didn't have that sort of sense of what they call in comics sense of wonder. You know, it didn't have that gee whiz factor. It was a little too adult almost, you know, a little too slowly paced, not really morbid, but really very focused on its self-seriousness. That works for some characters and it doesn't work for others.
I think there was one scene where they were about to say truth, justice, and the American way, which is a typical, that's what Superman's about, and they kind of just glossed over the American way part, that they didn't want to have Superman seen as this...
Yeah, I remember that being a little, the conservative columnists went a little nuts about that. They thought it was a sort of giving in to PC elements to leave the American way part out of it. You know, that's certainly part of Superman's character. You know, he landed in America, and his character has always really focused on embodying what was perceived at the time to be all-American values. And it's interesting to look at the comics, the superhero comics, through the years and see how Superman's politics have changed to reflect whatever the times are. In the early days when Superman was created in the late 30s, which was, you know, the hangover of the Depression, he fought sleazy landlords, and he fought people who were trying to bust up unions. And then, you know, in the 50s, he becomes really the sort of company man, you know, the man in the gray flannel suit reflecting all the Eisenhower Americanism virtues. And then you see him getting a little more idealistic in the 60s, and then he's back to being sort of a tool of the man in the 70s. And it's actually kind of fascinating to see that develop. So,
did you see Superman fighting the Nazis like he did Captain America?
You did to a certain extent, but not to a huge degree, and I think it's largely because the writers realized there was no way out of it, that if the Allies actually had a Superman on their side, there would be no way that they could not win the war in, you know, a week's time.
Yeah.
And in the 60s, a comics writer came up with kind of an interesting sort of retroactive solution for why that was. They invented this special gadget that the Nazis had that kept anybody with superheroic powers from entering Europe. And that was sort of their little retroactive explanation as to why all these superheroes didn't just cross over into Europe and defeat the Nazis in 5 minutes. So that's always an issue when you treat superhero comics realistically, which is a double-edged sword. In some ways, it's very successful. You know, one of the reasons The Watchmen is such a success is because it realistically asked the question, well, if these people were real, how would we react to them? What would they do to the world that we live in? But on the other hand, it leaves you with the question, well, what really prevents them from just going and, you know, winning a war in 5 minutes? Or what really prevents them from just telling us, well, we're in charge now and you do what we say? So it's very easy to get carried away with that sort of thing.
I want to go back here, and we have just a few minutes left, but I want to talk a little bit about Batman and Batman villains. We were discussing before how the villain really makes the story in terms of superhero fiction and really in action movies in general. And I always felt that the Batman villains were lacking. You had the Joker, even though he was played well by Jack Nicholson, the basic character, he's an insane guy, but doesn't really, he can't do anything special. He doesn't have any powers per se. Same thing with the Penguin. I mean, same thing with many different Batman villains. I'm just surprised it's never really been brought up much as an issue.
Oh, well, you know, here's where I'm going to have to really disagree with you. I mean, I know a lot of people think the same way, but I think, you know, the term in comics for your villain, your set of villains, is your rogues gallery. And I've always been hugely fond of Batman's rogues gallery. I've always thought it was very, very strong. And the reason that his don't have a lot of powers is because he doesn't have any powers. Batman is just an ordinary man. And if you throw him up against the sort of villains who fight the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, you know, Batman's probably going to get pounded. He's not going to fare well against a lot of super-powered opponents. But more importantly than that, I mean, what's always struck me as really fascinating about Batman's villains is that almost all of the best ones, and here, you know, I'm referring to the Joker, to the Riddler, to the Penguin, to a certain extent lesser ones like Killer Croc, Poison Ivy, is that they're all sort of dark reflections of his own personality. You know, whereas Superman and Wonder Woman and a lot of the bigger heroes, they fight villains who are purely villainous. Superman represents truth and justice in the American way, and Luthor represents the opposite of all those things, whereas Batman's villains all represent some aspect of his personality that, were it not for his self-control or just fortune or whatever, he could have gone that way as well, you know. The Joker has always been portrayed as this sort of madman who, like Batman, underwent a really traumatic experience, but his reaction was to turn out entirely different than Batman did. You know, he became a murderer and a lunatic, whereas Batman avoided that. And the Penguin is similarly a sort of embittered rich man who was part of high society and was then rejected from it for reasons beyond his control. And instead of, you know, adapting to that the way that Bruce Wayne did, he rebelled against it and decided to make the wealthy of Gotham City his prey. And Poison Ivy is a frustrated idealist, the same as Bruce Wayne is. And so to me, the appeal of Batman's villains is that, you know, when they're well handled, is that they're just they're mirror images of him. You know, they're things he could have become, and nowhere is that more clear than with Two-Face. You know, Two-Face is, his origin was that he was the district attorney in Gotham City and was one of Batman's best friends. And then when he was putting on trial a mob boss, the mob boss threw acid in his face and it scarred his face. And he became, you know, this sort of moral monster. But at heart, he was really almost identical to Bruce Wayne, to the extent that in a lot of the comics and even in a few of the movies, people have wondered if Harvey Dent, which is Two-Face's secret identity, is actually Batman, because their personalities and makeup are so similar. And, you know, I think that's why Batman's villains do work. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit that they haven't been treated especially well in the films. You know, I mean, when Poison Ivy, portrayed by Uma Thurman in the film, is just a caricature. They don't get into any of the interesting aspects of her personality. And I think they really mishandle the Penguin, as I said. But in the comics, I think they work spectacularly well because they really play up that similarity.
Well, I think certainly with a movie like Batman Begins, the recent Christopher Nolan take on the Batman franchise, you have, I think, the Scarecrow, who is played very well and very sinister, and is also given some sort of power in terms of the gas that he uses.
That's true, yeah, and that is based on the reality of the comic. They play him pretty close to exactly the same way as he is portrayed in the comic. But, you know, the main villain of the film, Ra's al Ghul, he's another classic Batman villain in that he's very similar to Batman, you know. In fact, in the film, he's the one who trains Batman. He's the one who sort of sends him on his way. And it's only because he takes the idea of justice so extreme and, you know, to such ends that Batman ends up opposing him, when in fact their sense of the corruption of society and the need to fight it are almost identical.
We just have a few moments left here. How about superhero films that you're looking very much forward to in the next couple of years?
Well, I mean, I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens with the Wonder Woman film. I don't know if it'll be great or whether it won't be, but I'm looking forward to seeing what happens, because it's a character that I think is really underutilized both in comics and on film. I'm excited about the next Superman movie, or the next Spider-Man movie, rather. I'm sort of looking forward to the next Iron Man movie, not so much because I think it'll be great, but because I just have a lot of affection for the character. The first Fantastic Four movie I thought was very disappointing, and squandered my favorite villain of all time, Dr. Doom, but I am still sort of looking forward to seeing the second one, seeing if it can be an improvement. And of course, just because it's been talked about for so long, I'd love to see The Watchmen finally made into a film, although I'm extremely skeptical about whether it'll be any good.
Yeah, I've told people that I think The Watchmen would work so well as something like a season-long HBO show.
Yeah, you know, it was made to be a miniseries, I've always said. Yeah.
Exactly. We have 11, 12 hours to really go into detail, and you go into it on an adult network, obviously, so you can be very graphic in terms of the presentation. And so I have a lot of difficulty seeing how that's going to play out over a couple of hours. Have they cast anyone as Wonder Woman?
No, they have not yet. There's been tons of names exchanged. I know for a long time, I don't recall her name, but one of the women who was on Serenity, the woman who played Inara, she was bandied about for quite a long time. And I think they were recently discussing Scarlett Johansson, but no one has been slotted into it yet. And, you know, of course, the casting is going to be key to the whole thing. So
we have Robert Downey Jr., I believe, is playing Iron Man.
Kind of a fun choice, I think.
I think so, too. And at something at the very beginning of the conversation, I mentioned Luke Cage, the upcoming Luke Cage film, and that's going to be directed by John Singleton. And Luke Cage was also known as Power Man in the Marvel Comics universe, and right. An urban hero, urban vigilante, actually, because he was actually a hero for hire.
Correct.
And I'm very much looking forward to that. I think that will be very interesting. It's almost like a blaxploitation kind of take on superhero.
John Singleton is a good choice to direct it, I think. So we'll see. There's also an Iron Fist movie coming out, which that was Power Man's partner in Heroes for Hire. Although who knows if that's going to be any good or not. I have heard nothing about who's directing it or writing it. But it's interesting that we're at a point now where even really minor characters like that are getting their own films.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and my guest today has been freelance writer and pop culture critic Leonard Pierce. Leonard is the senior editor of Hi Hat, the magazine on popular culture, and Hi Hat can be found at thehihat.com, and he also has a website, ludikid.com, ludickid.com. And you mentioned a couple of other blogs that you're working on. Why don't you run through those again?
Well, I also am a writer for Nerve.com's indie film blog, which is The Screen Grab. It can be found at thescreengrab.com. And I also maintain a political blog called Clown Central Station, which is at clowncentralstation.blogspot.com.
Thanks so much for coming back on the show, Leonard. I appreciate your time.
Good to be here.
For Leonard Pierce, my name is Kevin Fulham, and Leonard's writing can be found at ludikid.com. That's ludickid.com. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit undersurveillance.org. Once again, that's undersurveillance.org.